Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today I want to talk about the founding months and years, if you will, of the CIA and its development from 1944 onwards with the initial ideas of a Central Intelligence Service that were suggested by the CIA's first pioneer, General Wild Bill Donovan, who first put the idea to Franklin Roosevelt, who was ambivalent, but perhaps giving it worthy consideration. Perhaps unsurprisingly, the initial response by the other chiefs of staff and the heads of services from the Navy to the Army, to the Marines, was less than enthusiastic. The Office of Strategic Services had fewer men in the field by 1945 than it would take to fill the standard US division. The American expertise in spycraft was not particularly strong by midway through the war. Most of the understanding they had about intelligence, covert operations, sabotage, cryptanalysis, and that kind of thing came from the British. And if you look at the rather amateur hour nature of MI6 at the start of the war, and the abilities of, say, of people like Burgess, MacLean and Philby to easily infiltrate it, and its basis around, you know, public school and Oxbridge and that sort of thing, having MI6 as a role model wasn't necessarily the greatest start that the OSS could have had. The other service chiefs looked at the OSS and pointed out that it was made up of all manner of kind of eccentrics and adventurers and characters, if you will, as many pioneering intelligence services around the world in the 20th century tended to be in their infancy, because there were people that didn't fit into other services, people that were by their very nature mavericks who thought outside the box and who had other ideas about things, and who had a range of different roles in the civilian realm, who brought their expertise into the intelligence services. This is the kind of thing that makes Navy and Army men inherently suspicious and uneasy. They can't pinpoint specifically what this service actually does. And the problem that the CIA has when it is born into life under the Truman administration is that there's a huge question mark over what it's meant to be. Harry Truman famously said that really he wanted the CIA to be some kind of presidential daily bulletin, an information service that would help a fairly inexperienced new president without any of the kind of diplomatic background that Roosevelt had grown up with and had acquired by almost osmosis, being the sort of part of the kind of the political royalty that he was. It would be a service that could supply Truman with all the information that he needed. Quite literally, what Truman wanted the CIA to be was a piece of paper on his desk every morning explaining what was going on in the world. But Donovan had very different ideas. Donovan believed that the CIA would now be a guerrilla force taking the fight to communism wherever it was in the world. Now, this is interesting because it was by no means a given in 1945 that America's world role would be a relentless fight against communism. Really, it's only in 1947 with the Truman Doctrine that Truman, in support of Greece and Turkey, and witnessing Britain's retreat from its world role, realises that America cannot retreat back into isolation, even though this polls very well with the American population after 1945. There was a general sense of job done, mission accomplished, and time now to reap the benefits of peace. So the fact that there were branches of the United States government in 1945 that saw not just tension with the Soviet Union, but a generational struggle that they must wage is interesting from the point of view of historians of the early Cold War, because it shows, and this is hardly a revelation, that varying branches of governments have different ambitions, perspectives, objectives and viewpoints. And the problem that Truman would find with the CIA is that it would wind up with a virtually limitless budget and almost no congressional oversight, allowing it to fight the war that Wild Bill Donovan had always dreamt of. Now, the great book to read on this subject is Legacy of Ashes by Tim Weiner. And in it, he points out that Donovan was obviously an exceptional leader, but also a maverick and quite an eccentric. And he writes, "President Roosevelt always had his doubts about Donovan. Early in 1945, he'd ordered his chief White House military aide, Colonel Richard Park Jr., to conduct a secret investigation into the wartime operations of the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services. As Park began his work, leaks from the White House created headlines in New York, Chicago, and Washington, warning that Donovan wanted to create an American Gestapo. When the stories broke, the president urged Donovan to shove his plans under the rug. These were the plans for the Central Intelligence Service. On March 6, 1945, the Joint Chiefs of Staff formally shelved them. They wanted a new spy service to serve the Pentagon, not the president. What they had in mind was a clearinghouse staffed by colonels and clerks, distilling information gathered by attachés and diplomats and spies for the benefit of four-star commanders. Thus began the battle for the control of American intelligence that went on for three generations." So this throws another player into the story of the beginnings of the CIA, the Chiefs of Staff. There was an interest by them in an intelligence service, not the kind of guerrilla secret army that Donovan wished to create. By the way, stories of Donovan wishing to create an American Gestapo were obviously kind of quite ludicrous and far-fetched. It's certainly not what he was envisaging. Moreover, Donovan had some generally rather wildly romantic views of what a spy service should be, based on readings of Rudyard Kipling novels. And whilst that sounds absurd, it certainly holds up to the historical fact that Donovan and many of his compatriots had read the novel Kim which tells the story of the British Secret Service fighting a covert war in the Hindu Kush against the Russians. And this kind of daredevil, maverick view of the world had been implemented by Donovan during the war. Donovan parachuted American agents into Germany before the surrender, and directly into enemy territory. They were all captured and killed. He had, much as Churchill did, a new scheme or design or plan or concept virtually every single week. And it was even harder than it was for Churchill for subordinates to dissuade him and to change his mind. Donovan believed that anyone that didn't fully endorse his plans was in some way suffering from some kind of weakness or was sufficiently lacking martial spirit to give things a go. During the war, the OSS was generally frowned upon by the military, and the OSS obviously being, to all intents and purposes, a civilian organisation. They were, as spies generally tend to be, civil servants. The idea of a civilian spying agency, not a military intelligence bureau, was, with direct access to the president, was seen as a threat to their power and influence. And if you look at the history of the services, the American services, different branches of those during the war, and the amount of bickering, infighting, and demand for the president's attention and for governmental resources, is hardly a surprise that when a new agency put itself forward or was proposed, that there would be this kind of infighting. The Air Force, Navy, Army, and Marines all wanted to demonstrate their ability almost single-handedly to win the conflict, and it took the skillful managing of these by George Marshall and by Roosevelt to create a kind of a combined service approach. And if you go back a couple of podcasts to where we were talking about Roosevelt and Chamberlain, when Roosevelt himself proposed a predilection for the Air Force, service chiefs who thought that he had far greater fascination with planes than was healthy reminded him that by and large a correct combination of air power, infantry, armour, artillery and naval power was the way the war would be won. And obviously intelligence comes a great deal into this. Most of the significant breakthroughs, breaking of Japanese codes in the Pacific, that sort of thing, of the war, were done by signals intelligence, by cryptographers, by American equivalents of Bletchley Park, and indeed by ultra intelligence from Great Britain sent to America, which was Great Britain's Second World War super weapon, which provided the British with an ability to punch well above their weight as their military power began to decline. One reason for a newfound post-war enthusiasm for a combined intelligence service run by the military, a bureaucratic sifter of information, was the debacle of Pearl Harbor.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
All sorts of human and signals intelligence was pouring into America that the Japanese were planning something. There was an assumption that they couldn't possibly do anything as reckless as attack Pearl Harbor, and yet all indications pointed in that direction. And yet the information that Pearl Harbor was the likely target was not sufficiently passed around to Army or Navy service chiefs. The code itself that had been broken was so secret that it wasn't shared with commanders in the field. The infighting between the Army, the Navy, the Marines and the Air Force meant that different bits of the puzzle were hoarded and not shared. If you read Lawrence Wright's amazing book, The Looming Tower, about 9/11, a great deal of the explanation for 9/11 lies in this, and it was a turf war, really, in information between the CIA and the FBI. The CIA obviously likes to do spying, and the FBI, a policeman, like to arrest people, and this can often present a conflict of interests. And he makes a very compelling case that had the two sets of information being put together and shared, it would have been quite easy to arrest the 9/11 hijackers. There you go. The inability to put together the entire picture and to predict Pearl Harbor meant that a post-war congressional investigation concluded that poor intelligence is how America had been taken by surprise, and that intelligence would now be a key part of national security, but that did not necessarily mean in itself that a new intelligence service would or should be taking the fight to the Soviets. When Roosevelt died, Donovan believed that his best chance of creating a vast new intelligence service had died with him. Donovan and a future director of the CIA, then an OSS agent, William Casey, had both concluded that this was probably the end for any dream of creating the CIA, or the CIS as it was intended to be called at that point. Even worse, a dossier designed to strangle the OSS itself was compiled for Truman's consumption. It had been drawn up by the military adjutant Colonel Park, who had been the top advisor to Roosevelt, and it had been added by J. Edgar Hoover, FBI director, who despised the OSS and saw it as a threat to his own power. And Hoover himself hoped that the FBI could become the kind of global intelligence monster that the CIA became. Indeed, in the interwar years, the FBI were dispatched to keep eyes on fascist fifth columnists in Central and South America, and those nationalist regimes, people like the Peronist regime in Argentina, who had sympathies towards Hitler. Most of the work of the House and American Activities Committee that would later persecute communists had been originally designed to focus on the extreme political right, not necessarily the left. Hoover helped to create an impression of Donovan that he was a swaggering, incompetent, that the OSS had done far more harm than good and had been a threat to American interests, that the wild, maverick nature of the organisation, that had very little oversight, was a threat to the security of the United States. Hoover hated Donovan and wanted to present the OSS as having done, quote, serious harm to the citizens, business interests and national interests of the USA. What evidence there is for that is unclear. But there had been, there was also a suspicion in the greatly Anglophobic Hoover that the OSS had been used by the British and had been manipulated by them as they were inexperienced, and perfidious Albion had tricked them into extending British interests around the world. They had also, in the eyes of Hoover, been manipulated by Chiang Kai-shek in China, and had been played by the Nazis as their spying operations had been sort of thrown open by the Abwehr in Germany. All of this helped to increase Truman's suspicions. He was very wary of secret intelligence operations and covert operations that he had little or no understanding of. As with all these things, Donovan had made all sorts of clumsy mistakes during the war, but there had been some fairly successful sabotage missions, and the OSS had gradually learned on the job, and every Allied commando unit and saboteur unit had been pretty much the same. If you look at the history of the Special Operations Executive of Great Britain during the war, it's hardly crowned in glory. There are years of errors, blunders, and broken spy rings and codes, and then a number of significant successes. Truman had very little time, as we say, for Donovan, and it took. He gave Donovan 15 minutes of it shortly after May the 8th, 1945. So a week later. Donovan met with Truman, and Donovan began to make the case that a new struggle against the Soviet Union needed to begin as soon as possible, and it needed to be fought covertly. As you can imagine, at this point, Donovan has almost no credibility, and this maverick plan of his, which seems wholly unnecessary, particularly as Truman was looking at the detonation of the first atomic bomb that would be coming at some point in the next 4 months, as the method by which the Soviet Union would really be intimidated and held back. Donovan went to the press and went to Congress. He was fiercely critical of Truman and said of Truman that you had decided to abandon knowledge for ignorance, and that America had no coordinated intelligence system at all. And he said, the defects and the dangers of this situation have been generally recognised. 6 weeks after the dropping of the atomic bombs on Japan, the OSS was wound up and Donovan was fired. It seems that Truman had believed the Gestapo line, and incredibly, at the start of the Cold War, America's first spy service was abolished. Now, in the decision made by Truman comes the real birth of the CIA. The fact that a largely Anglophobic, well, perhaps Anglo-sceptic Washington now knew that the only pair of eyes that they had in the world were British, and that meant that British interests might well cloud American decisions, and British interests at this time, a hugely indebted country that had borrowed, taken a loan out from America at the end of the war in order to shore up its economy, and as the USA looked on with kind of great suspicion, build a welfare state, or, you know, amounted to socialism in the eyes of the US, and support its empire, another thing distinctly unpopular on the American side of the Atlantic, it was clear that the British had contrasting and very different intentions, even though they had been America's ally during the war. And this was a problem in the eyes of the intelligence community that could not persist. The development of the CIA was a way of creating an intelligence gathering service that was not beholden to Great Britain and would inevitably eclipse it. The Joint Chiefs of Staff still fought fiercely for a military intelligence service. But as the Cold War events from 1945 to 1947 heat up, and that Truman suddenly realises that the Cold War can't be ignored and must be fought, and that the Soviet Union and Soviet Communism will not quietly go away, that the CIA's hour comes around. And it's within the creation of the National Security Act of 1947 that the CIA finally finds its feet. It gets its budget and it's created in full. And the National Security Act 1947 creates the National Security Council, and it really creates the national security apparatus that Eisenhower would later go on to criticise and be distinctly alarmed about, and it creates the modern Pentagon as we understand it, and the Department for Defence. But principally for our purposes, it creates the CIA. And the CIA, it really relieves from congressional oversight and hands an enormous budget, the kind of funding that Wild Bill Donovan had always hoped for. So the takeaway thing from this is that the NSA 1947 and the development of the CIA are in part the kind of the product of the early stages of the Cold War, of the Truman Doctrine, of the withdrawal of the British and their intelligence gathering and their ability to be the anti-communist policeman in the Mediterranean in 1947, and the fact that this role was now thrust upon America, whether she liked it or not. What springs from that, hopefully we'll get to talk about in the future, the development of the CIA as this and this coup planning and delivering service for the presidency in places like Guatemala and Iran. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed this, and I'll catch you on the next podcast. Thanks, bye-bye.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.